Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For news about In Our Time and for recommendations about our archive, please follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoy the programmes. Hello. In 1576, the French political philosopher Jean Bodin set out his ideas about the nature of sovereignty in what became a landmark work, The Six Books of the Commonwealth. He was writing at a time of great conflict in France, the wars of religion between Catholics and Protestants, and a few years before the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, with kings, princes, the Pope, and aristocrats making overlapping claims for authority. Bodin wanted to find the defining qualities of the one supreme sovereign in a state. His ideas about sovereignty drew on Aristotle and profoundly influenced later thinkers such as Hobbes during the English Civil War, Rousseau ahead of the French Revolution, the leaders of the American Revolution, and we stop short of current affairs. With me to discuss the history of the idea of sovereignty are Melissa Lane, Class of 1943, Professor of Politics at Princeton University, Richard Burke, Professor in the History of Political Thought at Queen Mary, University of London, and Tim Stanton, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Politics at the University of York. Melissa Lane, Bodin read about the ancient Greeks. What would you have found there that would have helped him in his political theory?
Of course, in ancient Greece and across the ancient world, we have sovereigns in the sense of monarchs. But what Bodin was also very struck by was that in the Greek democracies, we find what we can think of as popular sovereignty, where the people are sovereign. And the advantage of the people over monarchs is that they're not underage ever, they don't get senile, so they have more claim in some ways to be absolute, supreme, perpetual, and even indivisible, which were some of the key marks of sovereignty that Bodin identified.
And also the Greeks set out the first, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, it might be the seventh, I don't know. Set out the first division, that there was a monarchical system, aristocratic system, and a democratic system. The three systems, they could be intermingled, they could intertwine, they could overlap, but these three were the three pillars of political theory.
Yes, that's right. And then in Rome in particular, and anticipated in some Greek thought, there was the idea that perhaps you could have a mixed regime, which actually combined elements of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. So we see that in the Roman Republic. And there it's very interesting where sovereignty resides, because we find in the Roman historians sometimes the people are described as having maiestas, as one term for sovereignty. Sometimes it's the Senate. And that would lead Bodin and Hobbes to think that actually in these mixed regimes it's a kind of fiction. There has to really be a sovereign underneath what seems to be a divided arrangement of power.
We slightly go before our horse to market here. Let's go back to Athens. Can you get an encapsulation of an idea of something like sovereignty that might have come out of the Athenian experience?
I think it is the idea that the demos, the people, are curios and in the state, so they are in control. They are the masters of the political regime, and that means precisely that they're supreme. No one can overrule them. They're not accountable to anyone else, and those ideas of not being accountable, not being beholden to anyone else, I think are really at the center of that idea of the people as, in a sense, sovereign.
And as in many cases, the Romans took over and developed all those ideas with the word you've once said, maiestas, but also summum imperium was another word that they had for what Bodin is calling sovereignty. Did they put any sort of spin on what the Greeks had done? Did they develop it or just accept it and get on with it?
One of the things the Romans do, and we see this especially in Cicero, is develop more of a legal framework for thinking about how the people might entrust their sovereign powers to their rulers. So the idea of the res publica, the res, is actually conceived as a kind of property, and the people can entrust it, they can deposit it. And even in the Roman Empire, the people have to confer their powers on the emperor in order for the emperor to actually be sovereign.
One of the things that Bodin had been, he'd been a monk, then he stopped being a monk, he was a classicist, and then he moved to be a lawyer and entered the parliament. The sovereignty was juridical. It wasn't a question of power. It was a completely different thing.
So I think that for Baudin is really interested in using a method of history, especially in his first important work before the Six Books of the Commonwealth, of universal history, to say even where people themselves didn't offer definitions of sovereignty, we can see this element of sovereignty in their legal arrangements. And he used that method to define it.
Richard Burke, I briefly skipped over Baudin. Can you tell us something more substantial about him?
Okay, well, Baudin was born in Angers, southwest of Paris, in 1529-30. The precise date's not clear, and died towards the end of the century in 1596. As was briefly mentioned already, as a very young man, he joined the Carmelite Brotherhood as a monk. There he would have received a detailed scholastic education. But he was actually released from his vows in 1549, and it's at that point that he embarked upon a legal career, or at least legal training, at the University of Toulouse. That was in the 1550s, but then, as you very briefly mentioned, in the 1560s he embarked upon a career as a public official, as an advocate in the Parlement of Paris. And this new development in his career coincides with the descent of France into turmoil. The wars of religion are triggered in 1562 and last until 2 years after Baudin's death. So his writing is very much constructed against that background.
Against that background, but do we know, Richard, do we know what prodded him to write these six books? Was there any particular incident? Had he been driving towards it in his previous work?
Well, I would say no particular incident. However, as a trained jurist with deep humanistic knowledge and a public official concerned with the fate of his Commonwealth or the monarchy of France, he developed his theory of sovereignty very much as a means of staving off convulsion, if you like, or the dissolution of the Commonwealth under pressure from religious and political faction. So it is, as it were, his preoccupations are triggered very much by contemporary events, but no one particular event.
So how did he define sovereignty?
Well, Baudin's theory of sovereignty is mostly developed in two works. One, The Method for an Easy Understanding of History, of 1566, and then especially in his most famous work, which is published in French in 1576, which is his six books on the Commonwealth. Now, there Baudin came up with a theory of political authority, essentially, a juristic one, as has already been emphasized, whereby it was essential for him to make plain that authority had ultimately to have some final point of decision making, and that's the essence of sovereignty for him. I suppose, as very briefly mentioned by Melissa, it's important to see what he saw as the four characteristics of sovereignty. It had to have especially these four traits. It had to be supreme. That's to say, there could be no superior to the sovereign, or would defeat the purpose.
Except God.
Indeed, and this is an important detail. But from a terrestrial or secular point of view, the sovereign could have no superior. Also, the sovereign was absolute, could be tried by no other tribunal. It was also essential that sovereignty be indivisible. We can come on to, if you like, what...
Tell us what you mean by that now.
Well, I suppose one of the... if I mention the last characteristic first and then come back to that, characteristic is more straightforward, that sovereignty should be perpetual. It can't be changing hands at interludes, so that would be destabilising. Indivisibility. Well, to understand indivisibility, it might be very useful to see how Baudin thought that the functions of sovereignty, which were essentially threefold, had to be held in one set of hands, if you like. Though I should say, not literally one set of hands, because as we've already established, a sovereign might be an individual, a monarch, or might be an assembly of the many, or might be an assembly of the few. But nonetheless, the sovereign ought to at once be responsible for legislation, the making of laws, but also for the right over war and peace, and also for the appointment of senior magistrates. Now, it made no sense to Baudin that these functions could be partitioned amongst different bodies, because that would be a recipe for dispute, the kind of dispute that France at the time found itself in the midst of.
Well, to go on from that, thank you very much, Tim. Tim Stanton, how could Baudin's ideas be applied to the France in great turmoil, religious wars, at the time that he was writing.
So France at the beginning of the 16th century is a relatively unified and united and strong state, but by the middle of the century that situation has changed somewhat. The monarchy is under pressure. There's been a long and ultimately unsuccessful war with the Spanish, which has reduced its finances, and it's had to meet the rising challenge of Protestantism, which is spreading across France, perhaps a million Calvinists, and this poses a very strong challenge to the traditional idea that the good order of a state depends upon a single ruler, a single faith, and a single system of law. And so what Baudin is interested in is thinking through the consequences of this new situation of potential fragmentation and instability, and how can we find a solution to that. And the solution he proposes is sovereignty.
So where did he find his basic idea of sovereignty from? Is there the war's going on all around him, it's let's not use the word cursed, but it's disturbed and upset and disrupted, and there doesn't seem to be anyone specifically in charge. Why did he say, freeze all this for a moment and let's go to the heart of things? What is wrong here is that there's no sovereignty in the state. How did he get to that conclusion?
Well, I think he got to it by reflection upon the situation in which he found himself, in which there were a variety of competing claimants, both de facto and de jure, for authority within the state. The state is divided socially and politically between different great families in different regions who exercise high degrees of patronage. There's also different political bodies which have a kind of quasi-autonomous existence within the state, leagues, confederations, guilds, and so on. And what he sees is that there needs to be, as Richard observed, a single point at which authority culminates. And from there, every subordinate body gets its meaning and purpose. So you have this single point from which everything else flows.
What did he draw on to get there? Melissa talked about the Greeks and the Romans briefly and so on. What did Baudin draw on? He said, this is where we should go. Was it what had happened in France? What did he draw on?
Well, intellectually, he drew on his humanist training, his knowledge of classic texts and also later juristic texts, medieval texts, texts of the writers such as Bartolus of Sassoferrato and Baldus, who had in various ways thought about what makes a political body rather than a collection of different competing political bodies. And what he's interested in doing is cutting through that problem by supplying what, in his view, hasn't yet been supplied even by Aristotle or Cicero, that's to say a definition that tells you what makes a political body a single political body rather than a seething mass of competing bodies.
The word sovereign could lead to the words kings. Was he looking back on French kings or other kings in other countries? Let's stick to France. French kings and saying that was when it worked.
Well, I don't think he was quite doing that. It's not the case that he thinks that there is some golden age in French history when kings enjoyed the kind of power that he's projecting through his definition of sovereignty. It's more an analytic implication of what it is to have a commonwealth at all. If you're to have a commonwealth at all, you need this kind of power at its apex.
Melissa Lane, to flip across the channel, Shakespeare took up the idea, whether directly or indirectly is not important really, in particular Richard II, where the body politic and the body natural divide. The body natural is the man who's going to get old, get ill and die, and the body politic is a man whose state is going to continue. So the king is dead, long live the king. Makes sense in that sense. Would that idea have been familiar to his audience? Was he taking up an aspect of the argument of Baudin, do you think, in Richard II?
I think there are even older roots as well in English legal thought. So in the course of the medieval period, this idea of the king's two bodies, as you said, the body politic and the body natural, had really been put to work in a number of decisions. So questions about if a young king tried to make a lease of land and then became king, was that lease of land alienating the land still valid because a king couldn't alienate, by definition, any part of the realm? So that idea of the king's two bodies, I think, is very much ingrained already in a tradition of English legal thought, as well as also in the continent.
But so when Shakespeare, happened on the stage, and Richard handed over his scepter and the bowl with the oil in it to Bolingbroke, people said, ah, yes, we know about that.
Well, they knew about it, but I think also the play really dramatizes the tensions that that doctrine raises. I mean, Harry Hinsley has said sovereignty is as much a problem as a solution, and I think we really see that in Richard II in the sense that you can say the king has two bodies, but what happens then when a person, Richard, hands over his crown, and he himself is perplexed by that. He says, now I have no name because he isn't any more the king. And there's a kind of paradox about, is it even possible for a king to divest himself of his sovereignty? So they knew about the doctrine, but the play really dramatizes for them the tensions, and it became a very political play for that reason.
Richard Burke, how useful were these discussions on sovereignty to rulers and political theorists, thinkers at that time, at the time of Bodin? Let's stick in the 16th century for the moment, or early 17th, go halfway through, something like that.
Okay. Well, there's no doubt that the ideas of Bodin were taken up. And for instance, if you take the case of of England, it's certainly the case that advisers of James I were familiar with the writings of Bodin. The same would apply to Charles I as well, for that matter. And generally speaking, I think it's possible to say that Bodin did influence a sort of attitude to administration, which is often described as absolutism, partly because one of his criteria for legitimate sovereignty was that it would be absolute. However, I think it's also important to see that this is sort of really a partial interpretation of what Bodin was interested in. It's crucial to recognize that for Bodin, a varieties of forms of regime would all equally have sovereignty, and the question is, where would the sovereignty be located in
it? Would it be in the people or the aristocracy
or
the monarchy?
Exactly.
Can we stick? Sorry to interrupt, but just to clarify it for myself, in the background of what you're saying, are they still thinking of the three possibilities: monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy?
Absolutely. Yes. That's it. They're largely thinking about the three possibilities, or other possibilities of mixing them. However, in Europe, aristocracies and democracies are not so prevalent regime forms, so the impact of Bodin was largely in the earlier phase, but not later, but in the earlier phase was on thinking about monarchy. But what I'm trying to suggest is that it's arguable that really this involved a distortion, that Bodin was not interested in absolute government, he was interested in absolute sovereignty.
Well, just distinguish that for us elliptically and brilliantly so we can go on from there.
Sure.
In absolute government, not in absolute sovereignty.
Well, he was interested in the location of the final rights of authority, sovereignty, which might be held by various kinds of body, rather than being interested in, if you like, effective centralized administration of a state. So it's the difference between centralized administration, if you like, and the location of a right to authority.
Melissa, you want to come in?
Well, one way to think about him not being interested in absolute government, as Richard said, is the point that you made earlier, Melvin, about the role of God and indeed of natural law in the system. So for Bodin, the king or a monarch was still subject to the laws of God, to natural law, and even to the fundamental traditional customary laws of the French kingdom, say. And so that in a sense puts limits, but the point is that no one else can enforce those limits on the monarch.
The first big hitter next to Bodin, excuse me, the first big hitter next to Bodin who comes into the discussion as we've scripted it really, Tim Stanton, is Thomas Hobbes, England, middle of the 17th century, great English philosopher, intellectual, And what did he, had he read Vaudin on Humes, what did he bring to the table?
Well, Hobbes brought to the table a very deep sense of the precariousness of the civil condition and of the state, and in the course of his life began an investigation into the question that really Vaudin is also asking: what is it that allows a state to exist and to subsist over time? And Hobbes comes to the conclusion that it's not at all clear that anyone had understood or been able to provide an adequate answer to that question until he did.
And of course there was the execution of Charles the First while he was writing, and so the king is dead, long live the king, didn't work because the king was dead and the interregnum took over and Cromwell, a non-king, took over.
So exactly.
Except, and he did all the same stuff, but that's another matter.
And well, exactly. Hobbes says he's when he comes to write his great work of political theory, Leviathan, he makes clear that he's talking in the abstract about the seat of power, not the person who occupies the seat. So the person could be Cromwell or Charles I or indeed Charles II. What he's interested in doing is explaining how occupancy of that seat gives life and form to a state. Unless someone occupies that seat, the state doesn't subsist. It reduces to this seething mass of competing parts. And Hobbes strikingly claims in his first major work of political theory that all politics to his own day has been like that. There hasn't been an adequate understanding of a body politic until he writes The Elements of Law.
And so, does he mean a sovereign body politic in the sense of...
Well, sovereignty is for Hobbes the essence of the Commonwealth, and he means two things by that. First, that it's essential to it, so you can't have a Commonwealth unless you have sovereignty. And secondly, he means that it's the life-giving principle for the Commonwealth. So essence is life, it's the formal cause of a Commonwealth that distinguishes it from the material out of which it's made. So if you don't have sovereignty, you can't have a Commonwealth, and that's Hobbes's brilliant contribution to thinking about sovereignty.
I'd like to stay with Hobbes for a while, because I think that was terrific, but I think there's further to go. So the king's dead, and there's no long live the king. So that monarchical idea is, to Hobbes's great disappointment, I presume, is not on. So he goes to what various people, starting with Athens, have called the real basis of power, the people. And he constructs the Leviathan, an ancient monster, a word from an ancient monster in the Old Testament. And this is, the Leviathan is what? And what does the Leviathan stand for?
Well, the Leviathan is a mortal god, as Hobbes says, and it stands both for God to its subjects and for the state to its subjects. And it is the collective embodiment of the power of the people, given expression through a representative. And that representative is a fictional person who bears the sovereignty of all of them. So the image, the famous image in the frontispiece of Leviathan, is very helpful in this connection, because it shows you both a large figure looming up out of the water with a face representing this fictional person, composed at the same time of lots of little people, little homunculi, who are the source of its power. And Hobbes says elsewhere in his writings that really it's the opinion of the people that gives power to the state, and nothing other than that.
But, unless you want to say something, do you mind if I ask you something first? Because I'd like to take on, because this is fascinating. But the people have to give power, and they can't get it back. So they're giving their natural rights away in order to be protected and secure. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, that's exactly what I wanted to say. That the transfer is, for Hobbes, the transfer is almost absolute. So the people are a disunited multitude, and as Tim was suggesting, they only obtain their unity by being embodied through the transfer of power to a sovereign. And only if that sovereign collapses or completely becomes incapable of performing the functions of protection that for which the people had transferred their power, only then does the sovereign lose power. But otherwise, their transfer is irrevocable.
Yeah, the tricky bit is, how do you get the people to do that? And what are the laws saying that the people, you should do this and give all your natural rights away and let it be? Who's going to, did he tell us how it's going to happen?
Well, this is very interesting. So Hobbes has two ways of thinking about that. He says one way is that, you know, we imagine the people sort of gathering together and actually doing it. But he also has a de facto route to sovereignty, where we look at someone one who in fact has become able to provide protection. And people should think to themselves, I'm willing to recognize that person as my sovereign. And in the period of the interregnum, I think that's really the critical political
We're
argument.
Still in theory. How did it happen? Do you know how? Did Hobbes suggest that it should happen this way? They should have elections. They should have representation from the shires. How did he make it happen?
Well, he didn't think that. The two routes that he talks about don't make any difference to the character of the sovereignty that's produced, and in fact it looks as if the first route, the juridical route in which people transfer rights irrevocably, is just a way of dramatising the consequences of having sovereignty. So in fact when Hobbes talks about what gives the sovereign power, it's the idea that the people obey without stint, that's to say without cessation of motion. So it's an ongoing process rather than a one-shot, once-and-for-all, irrevocable laying down of right. It's a settled disposition to obey, and the question then is what settles that disposition to obey, and there Hobbes gives accounts in terms of monopolisation of the pulpit by public doctrine teaching. If people don't know their duties, Hobbes says, they'll never obey.
It's helpful to think about some of the people Hobbes was opposing. So in the course of the English Civil War, for example, there was the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, which claimed that it's only parliaments that can embody sovereignty because, in some sense, parliament represents the people in the sense of being a kind of virtual depiction of the people as a whole. And Hobbes thought, no, it doesn't have to be only parliament. It can be a monarch. It can be a... So he objected to that view that there was something unique about parliament. But, of course, from the other side, there were also people attacking the parliamentary doctrine, saying there has to be a stronger relationship of mandation or requirement of parliament to be authorized in an ongoing way through election. So you have a kind of spectrum of views in the 17th century.
Before we move away from Hobbes, and I want to come to Richard to talk about Rousseau, how did it go down? This came out, there you are, that's the solution. What did people think?
It's seen as a very radical doctrine, and because of the mortal God point that Tim mentioned, it's seen by some as even a kind of heretical doctrine. So he's attacked very violently. He's seen, in a way, as Machiavelli had been seen previously, as a kind of a threat in some ways, precisely because he's so ecumenical as to what body can be sovereign. It could be a democracy, it could be an aristocracy, it could be a monarchy. So for many people who were invested in the thought that only kings can be legitimate or only crown and parliament can be legitimate, that was a very threatening set of ideas.
He also had a rather pessimistic view of human nature and of life, that life was nasty, brutish, another thing, and short.
Nasty, yes. That's right.
Let's move to Rousseau now with Richard Burke. Rousseau wrote The Social Contract in 1762. More than 100 years after Hobbes. And he's the next big beast that comes into view for this conversation. Who for him is the sovereign? Where does sovereignty lie for Rousseau?
Okay, well, I think the best way of coming at that question is to explain Rousseau's position in the tradition of discussing sovereignty. The Social Contract of 1762 is often seen as being part of a longer conversation, but I think it's very important to see that, as well as obviously picking up on previous discussions of the theme, Rousseau is really innovating very radically with this doctrine, and he essentially revolutionises the concept of sovereignty in the following way. Previous theorists had discussed sovereignty as being taking three possible forms, as we've already seen. This is not possible for Rousseau. For Rousseau, sovereignty can only take one form, and it must be democratic sovereignty. So we spoke already about the transfer of sovereignty that one gets, for instance, in Hobbes' theory of the construction of the state. There is a multitude which forms a people and then can transfer its sovereignty to, for instance, a single will. This is an invalid move, according to Rousseau. His fundamental goal is to try and address the question of how is it possible for human beings to subject themselves to the rule of others without them sacrificing some fundamental part of their humanity, and that fundamental part of their humanity is their freedom. And in order to preserve that, Rousseau develops the idea of the as it were, moral, the normative necessity of popular sovereignty rather than sovereignty in general. So sovereignty must reside with an assembly of the people. However, I think it's probably very important not to confuse that with full-blown democratic thinking, because whilst it's the case that you have a popular or democratic sovereign, the main business of politics on a day-to-day basis, even in Rousseau's state, is handled by officials, by an administration. And that administration, for Rousseau, might legitimately be monarchical or aristocratic. In fact, it's very important to recognise that for Rousseau, you couldn't have a democratic government. You could have a democratic sovereignty, that's to say you could have an assembly forming to establish fundamental laws and the tenure of rulers, but not to administer the day-to-day business of politics. Where that did happen in the past, in Athens, Rousseau felt that it had been an unsuccessful, fractious, persecutorial regime. So he's not a democratic thinker in any simple sense, a democratic theory of sovereignty, but not of popular government.
These theories always break down when they have to trust the people. They don't want to, do they?
Well, that's
very
true.
They don't want to have the people in on the act. Not really. Well, maybe they do, but they don't seem to. Anyway, Tim Stanton, how did his ideas play out in the French Revolution?
Well, I think they played out in different ways depending on how they were construed, but also the idea of Rousseau himself was tremendously important in the French Revolution.
Oh, he was a great, the noble savage, the innocent child.
Kind of exemplar of the kind of virtue that the state ought to exhibit. So lots of people were wrestling with the problem that you just drew attention to. How do you make this work? It's one thing to say we have a democratic sovereign and this is the source of all legislative power within the state, but what does that mean in practice? And there are really two dominant ways of trying to work that out in practice. So one way of working it out, which is associated really with the CAs, is to try to establish a representative model which does away with the worst aspects of Hobbes's theory of representation. So you have, to begin with, the idea that by a kind of natural law, people form a state, a corporate body, then that corporate body develops its own single general will, but then what do you do? And Sieyès's answer is that you need a system of representation to filter that will through various representative institutions which speak for, through their interaction, the totality of the nation. So he's arguing that popular sovereignty must mean national sovereignty, where the nation is construed as the mass of ordinary people in the Third Estate, as his famous pamphlet, What is the Third Estate?
Sooner or later, we're going to have to get on the point of what influence did these ideas have on the actions of the time, but this is good going on with the theories. Richard Burke, when looking at the relationship between sovereignty and power, America, the American Revolution, is a wonderful test case. So tell us why I think it's, or we think, you think it's a wonderful test case.
Okay, that's indeed a very interesting case, and I think we should probably recognise the following first, that so far we've been talking about sovereign states, but of course the states of Europe in the 17th and particularly the 18th century were not simply states unto themselves, but were empires. And so the issue and problem surrounding sovereignty were in due course transferred to thinking about this wider domain. So in 1764, the British government of the day imposed a new regime of taxation on the Americans, the Stamp Act, really as a way of addressing problems with the British Exchequer in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War. However, it was soon discovered that the imposition of the Stamp Act was not successful, and by 1765, the Americans were in a state of very active protest. With a change of government the following summer, in July 1765, the Rockingham administration, the Rockingham Whigs, decided they were going to have to deal with this problem, and recognized very soon that they were not going to be able to impose their will on the Americans. Whatever the rights of the matter, they weren't going to be able to impose their will on the Americans. And as a result, over the next 6 months or so, they developed a position whereby they would repeal the Stamp Act, so they would not pursue this measure of taxation, but they would at the same time promulgate a law, a declaratory act, and that declaratory act was an assertion of British sovereignty over the colonies, and it's stated that Parliament has had and does have and always will have the right to bind the colonies in statute and by law in all cases whatsoever. That's roughly a paraphrase of the Declaratory Act. So they were asserting sovereignty whilst relinquishing power. We can't actually impose our will, but we nonetheless want to at the same time assert our right to final authority over the empire. Now, this was a very controversial declaration that was opposed by William Pitt the Elder, Lord Chatham at the time, and so there was a lively debate in British political culture about the nature of sovereignty versus its enforceability. So you might have a sovereign right, but that doesn't mean you can actually enforce it, and that was the key recognition of this period.
And do you want to add anything, or can I move on, Melissa? You're nodding away like mad there. We can move on. Right, thank you. Right, go back to Tim. Was it the idea of sovereignty, did it become accepted in European thought, let's stick to Europe for the moment, European thought, as a useful tool for bringing new countries together out of the multiple states there were in Europe at the time?
Well, a useful tool, certainly, but also a potentially very hazardous one for its user. So there's a great ambivalence about sovereignty, and indeed popular sovereignty, which is a legacy of the French Revolution. The French Revolution doesn't end especially well, and so there's a great fear, actually, of popular sovereignty, and by the same token, some fear that the obvious alternative to that system of representation leads in a more or less direct line to Napoleon and Bonapartism and the representation of the nation by a single dominant figure. And so throughout the 19th century, really, there's an attempt to navigate between those two poles while at the same time accepting that Rousseau, in a sense, has triumphed. Democratic sovereignty looks now to be the only legitimate form of sovereignty you can have. The question is, how can you have it in a framework which is still redolent of the different forms of government that have been established in the classical writers? So you still have monarchies, you still have aristocracies, you still have democracies as forms of government, but the underlying sovereignty now, it's accepted, has to be really democratic sovereignty.
Like the tide coming in, but how far is it coming in, and who's on that tide? It's a long fight, isn't it, Melissa?
Yes, and I think this problem about the relationship between representative government and democratic sovereignty really is at the heart of then the political struggles in the wake of the American and French revolutions going forward, and really remains in some ways a theoretically unsettled question in some sense. How is it that the people can, in some sense, lend their sovereignty and have it be exercised in a meaningful way by a form of representative government and yet in some sense also retain it. So in the American Revolution, for example, we see actually the very first popular referendum, as our colleague Richard Tuck has pointed out, ever in the world, was in Massachusetts in 1778, where it was an attempt to ratify a state constitution. And we see there for the first time the thought that there's some role for a popular vote in relation to the fundamentals of a constitution.
Is theory exercising authority and power in the discussions, or could you say, look, what's really happening is that states are clashing because of power grabs, because of economic circumstances, and so on and so forth? We're talking about a great political theorist, but that's what this program is based on. Is theory coming into arguments which really matter, coming into events that really matter?
I think a great example where we really see that happening is Thomas Paine and the pamphlet,
yes,
Common Sense, in 1775, which almost single-handedly actually rules out the sort of popular acceptability of a monarch, a sovereign in America, really through ridicule. So he ridicules the idea that monarchs can, given that they might be senile or fatuous or in other ways kind of inadequate to the task, why would you want a monarch exercising your sovereignty? And really kind of single-handedly that changes the thinking and practice of the American Revolution.
Would you go along with that, Richard?
Yes, and I'd go along also with the general point, really, that what we have is an attempt by a set of arguments to really understand the conditions under which they are living, And we find that, you know, one ends up with dispute over these various options for the understanding of sovereignty. So rather than being an item which maintains its stability and durability throughout the 700 years that we're discussing, rather we're talking about a sequence of disputes over contentious and vying interpretations of the nature of political power.
And I think Richard's absolutely right, and that comes out very clearly in the ratification debates in America after the Constitution is proposed, because of course those debates are soaked in theoretical reflection about the nature of sovereignty, how you can combine the sovereignty of states with a confederation or indeed a united states, a unity of states, and lots of people are very worried about the threat of being impaled on the horns of a Hobbesian dilemma. Either you have a confederation, in which case you don't have a single unitary body at all, or you do have a united body, in which case the sovereignty of the states disappears. And so theory is playing a very important role, not just in explaining the issue, but also in legitimation, in trying to legitimate whatever settlement comes out of the discussions.
To come back to where we started from, or where we nearly started from, it seemed to me that Baudin set people impossible goals. Sovereignty had to be supreme, absolute, indivisible, and perpetual. It's a hard act, isn't it?
I think that's a really important point, because there's a sense in which Baudin thought he was or claimed to be giving a definition, but in a way he's actually setting out a very high and strong specific theory about sovereignty, and I don't think that we necessarily have to agree with that theory. In fact, insofar as it seemed to rule out the possibility of mixed constitutions, mixed regimes, I think history actually in some way can be thought to refute it, that we actually do see, in some sense, even if we can imagine popular sovereignty as united and indivisible, in fact, it has to always be manifested and operated through some channel in which it appears divisible. So that paradox, I think, does mean we can't just accept Baudin at his word.
Finally, Richard Burke.
Yes, and coming back to Baudin, again, it's worth bearing in mind that he was a lawyer, and therefore his theory of sovereignty was juridical. But, of course, a juridical conception of authority is not necessarily adequate to capturing all aspects of political power. So you might have supreme legislation, but nonetheless be able to control very little. And that, in a way, was the lesson of the American Revolution. So sovereignty does not mean controlling your destiny.
Well, thank you all very much indeed. Melissa Lane, Richard Burke and Tim Stanton. Next week, we'll be talking about the invention of photography and its impact on the 19th century. Thank you very much for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Well, we didn't get into the 20th century, really.
No, deliberately, not.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I mean, today, well, being the day it is deliberate.
No. But I mean, even without going to current affairs, I think what we could say is that one of the debates we've seen around the UN, for example, is the question, you know, do sovereign states have the right to do anything they choose within their boundaries if they're recognized as sovereign externally by their fellow states? And there's been a real kind of struggle at the level of the UN to say, no, actually, states have a responsibility to protect their citizens. There is some kind of internal standard they have to meet.
Whether you have the right to go into Yugoslavia or interfere in Sierra Leone or something. Yes, yes.
There's certainly more to be said about the French Revolution. After all, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen was very much asserting in one of its articles that sovereignty essentially resides in the nation. And the working out of the implications of that statement, embodies a lot of subsequent history, if you like. I think it's probably right to say that some really epochal events cast a long shadow over debates about sovereignty, and we did touch upon them, the American Revolution and the French Revolution.
We didn't mention the English Revolution, oddly enough.
No.
Because I suppose Hobbes had given us enough of England. Do you think he had, Tim?
I think he did. I mean, we didn't really get into some of the details of his objections to the parliamentary case for sovereignty, which are very interesting, because, of course, he thinks that they're learning very bad lessons from their classical predecessors and trying to chop the kingdom into small pieces, really. And so the question for him is about who bears sovereignty and why it has to be borne only in one place. And I think, I mean, one question we didn't get onto, but perhaps could have done, is whether that kind of personal predication is always necessary. So is sovereignty something that can be ascribed to a system of law, let's say, rather than to a person, whether that person's a natural person with a head and two arms or a fictional corporate person like a state? Can you speak of the sovereignty of law? And that debate becomes very heated and important during the days of the Weimar Republic in Germany, where lots of words, ink, and eventually blood is spilt trying to work out the answer to that question.
One thing about Hobbes, I think, that he had an impact, his radicalism, I think it was his tone that put people off, this nasty brutish, people didn't want to think life was like that, did they?
Yes, I think, it's a very good point. That's to say, 20th century commentary associates Hobbes with absolutism and therefore some, sort of retrograde moment in history, whereas I think it's very important to recognise that he was precisely a radical thinker. Let's look at the arguments that no longer seem to have much valence after Hobbes. First of all, the theocracy, that's to say that authority derives straightforwardly from gods, and that would be interpreted by, a priestcraft. And equally, patriarchalism, that, the sons of Adam by right rule. By the 18th century, these are not viable, they're basically on the way out of systems of argument, and rising in their place is some kind of neo-Hobbesian doctrine of popular sovereignty. The crucial thing is that this was then subject to disputatious interpretation. It's not as though there was then a sort of template which people could interpret. They struggled over the meaning of the implications of that contribution to the debate.
I mean, I think it's also very important that one of the most important legacies of Hobbes is the idea that representation, in a sense, is the first idea, and democracy needs to be understood through it, rather than having democracy as the kind of dominant idea and then representation as an attempt to make democracy work in practice. I mean, there's a sense in which you can interpret Hobbes as moving in that direction through the three great works of political theory that he is responsible for. So by Leviathan, you don't have the sense that you begin with a kind of popular sovereignty, democratic sovereignty, and then that's handed over to someone to represent. The whole idea of having a people in the first place is tied to the notion of a representative. If you don't have a representative, you don't have a people. So there can't be a popular sovereignty that precedes representation.
Just a separate point, actually, that I think, if we're talking about the things that we didn't discuss that would have been very useful to discuss, or certainly bear strongly upon this topic, is, of course, the dissolution of European empires in the 20th century, all conducted in the name of popular sovereignty. So the Habsburg monarchy, the British Empire, so on and so forth, these release into the world, many micro-popular sovereignties. And that, as it were, if you like, secessionist pressure brought about by popular sovereignty is something we still live with.
Thank you very much. We've got our producer coming in, Simon, with the announcement of something you can't resist.
You can't resist tea or coffee.
There are more than 700 programmes to download and listen to for free from the In Our Time website, where you'll also find a reading list for this episode.